Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and we have an absolutely jam-packed show today without any room for me to talk and editorialize really in front of it. So I'm going to jump right into this right now, talking about our social media and our subscriptions. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you are missing out on the easiest way to listen to the show. You just go search for What Matters in North Carolina wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can get the show to your phone, device, your tablet, whatever, your computer, however you listen to podcasts with no effort from yourself. You will get all of these shows of What Matters in North Carolina throughout the week. Also, if you're not already following along on social media, you're missing out on engaging with us at What Matters in North Carolina. So if you want to engage with us, search What Matters NC on Facebook and Twitter, like our page, follow our page, and you can keep up with what's going on there. Also, if you want to hear more episodes of What Matters in North Carolina or the other shows on the Freedom Action Network, do so by going to freedomactionnetwork.com and listening to those shows there. Now, today we will have Susan Myrick of the Civitas Institute talking with us about mapping the left and updating us on what's going on there and the connections to different people from the Durham protests where the Robert E. Lee statue was pulled down have to different policy nonprofits, policy groups in the state. We'll be talking with Demi Doughty about ESPN's decision to pull Robert Lee, an Asian man or man, an American man of Asian descent, from calling the season opener game between Virginia and William & Mary purely because of his name, of Robert Lee. And then we will talk with Bob Lipke about school choice. This is our back to school segment and talking about the explosion of school choice in the state. That's charter schools, that's homeschooling, that's private schools. That is giving parents more of a choice in how their student is educated. So now we will move right into our segment with Susan Myrick. All right, now we are welcoming Susan Myrick to the show. Susan is the elections policy analyst for the Civitas Institute, but that is not the only hat that you wear, is it, Susan?
That's right. One of many.
One of many, definitely. And you are here to talk about one of those hats, which is, I think, a very big hat, very big project for yours, and that's mapping the left. That's something came out a couple years ago. People probably remember it vaguely if they haven't been paying enough attention. But it's still a relevant thing, and that's why you're here today, right?
I am here today for that reason, and something happened last week that just really moved me to discuss this, and it really is the reason why we developed Mapping the Left. And just to tell you a little bit about Mapping the Left.
There we go.
MappingTheLeft.com, it's a website, but it's built around a database. And we at Civitas for years were scratching our heads, listening to the left say that there was a great right-wing conspiracy. And we'd always, you know, try to count the groups on the right in North Carolina and could never get past 10. But when we started counting the groups on the left, we ended up having to put it in a spreadsheet. So the spreadsheet grew and grew until we reached just about 200 groups, 200 different groups in North Carolina.
200 groups.
200, and there's more than that than there was a few years ago. 200 groups, over 300 funders of those groups, giving major money to the leftist socialist wing of the liberal progressive left, and over 2,000 people either working in the organizations or on the boards.
Okay. And I have a question, and you may not know the answer to this. So you said 300 funders. Do you have any kind of figure for how much money that is? I mean,
I wish I would have looked at that before I came, but millions and millions and millions of dollars, because the biggest funder that they have actually comes from a foundation in North Carolina called Z. Smith Reynolds. And anytime there's any leftist movement in North Carolina, if they're on the march, whether it really is a march or whether it's, complaining about budget cuts to their pet programs, you're going to find Z. Smith Reynolds. They may not be right there in front of you. They may not, their staff may not be there, their board members aren't there, and they may not be carrying signs, but they're there. They're there in every group you see. They've funded them with millions and millions of dollars, and they've organized those groups. They've actually created a group called Blueprint NC that does the organizations, because they got tired of throwing money after money, funding the same or different groups doing the same thing. So give them kudos. That's smart. So they actually organize a group so that they're getting the biggest bang for their buck.
Okay, and Z. Smith Reynolds, that's old tobacco money, right?
Well, no. Well, it, you could say it is. It actually does come from R.J. Reynolds' family stock, but it was the inheritance of R.J. Reynolds' youngest son, Z. Smith Reynolds, who died tragically when he was 21 years old from a gunshot wound at his party, his birthday party. That most of that money came from him and from his uncle William, who, and long story, you can find it at www.mappingtheleft.com, but his uncle William, who helped raise the children after R.J. Reynolds died. But anyway, anywhere you see the left and progressives rallying, marching, protesting, whining, you're going to find Z. Smith Reynolds money. And that's exactly why I'm here today, to talk about two very different articles that I read, and that probably at least one of them almost everybody listening to this broadcast knew about. But the first one was about, it was an AP article written by Robertson. I can't remember his first name. But he was talking about cuts to legal aid in North Carolina. And most people know what legal aid is. It was news to me. I did not know Legal Aid North Carolina was a nonprofit organization, but it is. And when I read the article and I looked a little bit deeper into it, I discovered that it was a nonprofit, and right then and there, I said, I've got to look at their records to see exactly where they get their money. They were crying because...
Well, first, for the people who don't know what legal aid is, though, let's kind of dig in and let people know what legal aid is and what they do.
Well, legal aid is a nonprofit organization, like I said, and what they like to say they do is to help poor people with civil cases. Poor people that don't have the money to go to a lawyer, and so they're there for them in whatever civil case it may be, which sounds all well and good, and helping poor people is a great and wonderful thing. But what the article was about was their funding from the state being cut back, and it had been cut back. Actually, in the last 8 years, it's been cut back a lot. At 8 years ago, they were probably getting about $6.3 million from the state, and it had been cut all the way back to 2.7. This year, they even cut it back further to 1.1, and they did not know why this was happening. And according to the article, Tim Moore, the Speaker of the House, said that they had been getting reports that the legal aid and two other groups, actually, that do the very same thing as legal aid, they're very well connected, were working in a way that it was hurting especially mom and pop landlords. So you'd have a person that owned a house, or you know, rented out the garage or whatever it was, and they'd have a renter that didn't pay the rent, and they tried to evict them. And evidently what legal aid was coming in doing, setting up stumbling blocks, asking for things that cost a whole lot of money, and all the while that renter, or what used to be the renter, would be living there for free. And they were trying to, they didn't want that to happen anymore, especially with state money. So that's why they were cutting them back. And even though the director from the groups sounded like he didn't know what was going on, in the end, he had every indication he knew why they were cutting his money back.
And this wasn't a isolated one or two people at Legal Aid, was it? Would it appear to be a larger group within Legal Aid, or?
Well, it sounded to me like it was the modus operandi. It was the way they worked their cases. They were going to do everything they could to keep the people in their housing, whether they're paying rent or not.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out, you know, in the end, you think that they're going to be really hurt, and yeah, they're probably going to miss that money, but that's not the only money they get. Come to find out, they get anywhere from around $30 million a year from federal grants and state grants and things like that. And also, with a little bit of look, I find that Z Smith Reynolds actually funds them too. When I had gone to their website, they said something about social justice and justice in that way. And so I pretty much knew that they were on the lines that Z Smith Reynolds Foundation would want to fund, and they do. And so that was our one connection. So we've got Z Smith Reynolds, millions of dollars funding into Legal Aid of North Carolina. And then what happens last week that everybody knows about?
And what's that?
The Durham County desecration and bringing down of the Confederate monument.
Oh, yes.
And then they start arresting the protesters. And there's eight of them, I think, finally, in the end. Eight so far.
Something around that number, yes.
And they came from places like the first one. Her name was Takiya Thompson. She was part of the World Workers' Party, which is a communist, revolutionary Marxist-Leninist group. Out of Durham.
That's a lot of ists.
It is.
I don't think I have that many ists attached to my ideology.
They actually defend North Korea and the dictator. That's how far left they are.
How many hoops do you have to jump through to defend North Korea and Kim Jong-un?
It's tough. And they do.
I don't think I could find myself getting there.
Well, they call the U.S. They wanted to defend them against U.S. imperialism. So, and then there was another arrestee named Dante Emmanuel Strobino. We know him from protests in 2009, 10, 11. He's a serial arrestee that seems to like to organize young people. He's 35 years old, and he's part of the FIST, Fight Imperialism Together group, and it's a socialist organization in Raleigh. But then we get into a couple of other people, Raul Jimenez. He is a board member of a group called Social Vision Alliance. Ngoc Long Tran is also a staff member and communications director for Southern Vision Alliance. And then there's Elena Everett, who is the director of the Southern Vision Alliance. The last one from this group called the Southern Vision Alliance, Peter Gilbert. He was arrested in the same incident.
So they were out there in force.
And once you start looking at Southern Vision Alliance, you see that Z. Smith Reynolds is a funder of theirs too. In 2015, they gave him $100,000. But Peter Gilbert, here's another connection. Peter Gilbert's married to Elaine Everett. I mentioned her as a director, but he's also an attorney for
Legal Aid
of North Carolina. It's a circle. It's a circle with a lot of little lines running from one person to another.
I mean, it's a spider web, right?
It is a spider web. It is. It's a big spider web.
And is the center Z. Smith Reynolds, it seems?
I call them the mothership.
That'll work.
The mothership. And they're always there. You just have to look a little bit deeper to find them.
So it sounds like, I mean, this is a really... It's going to sound like I'm throwing a pun out of being cliche, but it's a very mapped out thing that you've been working on, which makes sense considering it's called Mapping the Left.
That's right. And, you know, when we were creating Mapping the Left, we tossed around names a lot. And the first name was Mapping the Left, and everybody was like, well, maybe yes, maybe no. But we couldn't come up with anything better because in the end, it is truly mapping one person to another organization, to another person, to another organization. And all the lines intersect somewhere, sometimes more than once. And it's a huge map in all of North Carolina. And that's usually the biggest question I get when I'm talking to people. They always stop me and say, now you mean this is just North Carolina? And yes, this is just North Carolina.
I mean, I've pulled up the site now, and it looks like a spider web. It looks, there are lines going all over this thing, connecting funders and people and groups and networks. And
that is the one thing in Mapping the Left, the cohesive part is networks. You've got to belong to a network. The group has to belong to a network in order to get into the Mapping the Left database. We get telephone calls and emails from people on the left wanting their name to be put in Mapping the Left. I guess it's a badge of something for them. But unless they belong to a group that's part of a network, they won't get they won't get a place in Mapping the Left. So
they have to step their game up, I guess.
Yes, they do. They need to work hard. And I'll help them if I can.
Yeah, I found one network that only has one line, but the rest of
these... I know
who
it is.
Who's that?
Acorn.
No, actually, it's the Immigration Network. It's El Pueblo.
Actually, that is a newish network. We're just beginning that one, but there's more groups.
And I've found Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation's network, too, and there's a lot here, but a lot of names that I recognize that are out there in front. Equality NC, Democracy NC, NAACP, Common Calls, ACLU of North Carolina, I mean, Clean Water.
Keep looking, you'll find Southern Vision Alliance, too.
I mean, I'm just scanning across these, and, you know, North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, NCC. I mean, it's very much, these are people who I recognize. These are names who I recognize. This is a real network here.
It is a network.
So I guess what's next here? I mean, what?
Well, we're in the middle of refreshing the network. You know, it changes. Everything changes all the time. People move. We've discovered that people move within the networks constantly. Groups go to sleep for a little while. They come back. They have to rejuvenate, get people moved around, so it's a constant updating of the groups and the funders and the foundations. So we're in the middle of that. We're getting ready to get ramped up because we can see new groups organizing and old groups coming back to life because they're ready to take over the legislature in 2018.
So one group that's come to my attention recently, and I don't know if it is on Mapping the Left yet, or if it belongs on Mapping the Left, but it's this group Indivisible. Have you come across them yet?
I have seen them. I have not. They're not in Mapping the Left yet. I will do some research on those to make sure that we can get them in the network, and if we can, they'll end up there.
Right, because I've noticed that them involved a lot as this new issue has come up, the Charlottesville issue, the Confederate monuments and statues issue. I've seen this group a lot, and I've looked into them a little bit.
Did you?
And they are... purely, their goal is to be stumbling blocks for Trump to attack President Donald Trump. That is their 100% goal. They essentially they want to do for Trump what the Tea Party did for Barack Obama. Is essentially their goal in mind.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
And their name is what makes me remember them so
Indivisible.
Much. Indivisible.
Are they from North Carolina, or are they?
They're nationwide, okay. And there's a few chapters in North Carolina.
Okay.
But what strikes me about their name is that, in trying to be indivisible, they just seem so divisive.
They do. That sounds like they are, and so that makes sense for a left wing group to go opposite of their intent and name themselves something that doesn't even come close to relating to their mission.
So, I guess who's your favorite group? I guess this is probably a horrible way to put it, but what's the group that jumps out to you on Mapping the Left when I ask about it?
Democracy North Carolina.
Okay.
I think they're the most important group. I think, and I've got to give kudos where kudos is due. I think Bob Hall, while I believe he's done the most to hurt North Carolina, he's the most well-connected. I believe he can. I think he can call the New York Times up today and have an op-ed tomorrow in the New York Times. I think he is that well-connected nationwide in the state. I believe he probably calls a lot of shots.
I mean, I searched him when you said that, and so. Or not him, but Democracy NC. And apparently they're a group and a network.
They are a group and a network. They were part of the reason we put it in this format. Once we started keeping a list of all the groups, we found that the left really liked to network. And they liked memberships. And they had a membership group. They've since taken it down off their website, I guess. Maybe we touched a nerve. But... they really liked that. The Blueprint NC was a membership group, Partners in Democracy NC, and that we just started seeing those lists of members or partners. We said, this is what they like. This makes sense. Again, most of these groups belong to several networks. A lot of the people belong to to several groups are either on the boards or work for them. It is a very cohesive group, and you'll see them. You'll see new groups pop up that are probably not really new groups. They give them a new name and they shift the people over there. Whatever works at the time is what goes on with the left.
Okay, and I think I need to get off of this window or off of mapping the left and maybe put it away till I have some time, because that's a rabbit hole I can easily see myself falling into.
You can really get caught up in it.
If the listeners want to go to mapping the left, make sure you have time. Make sure you have like a beverage close by to stay hydrated. You're going to be there for a while. There's a lot of information to dig into, I think.
That's the truth.
So is there more that you have to talk with us about today?
No, not today. I thought this was a very simple illustration of what mapping the left can help people understand, in that when you're reading these articles, and while you might think they're just a little snippet of news, a lot of times you can find the connections with just a simple question, and that's what the mapping the left is all about. Like I said, you can find Z. Smith Reynolds whenever the left is on the move. It's typical that you can find them in universities and public schools and daycares, but you can also find them when people are talking about voting and abortion. It runs the whole gamut from them. They are going to be there to make the change to the most radical element in North Carolina.
All right. Well, thank you for coming in, and make sure when there's some more updates, you come back and tell us about them.
Thank you, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Poulter uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. So now we are going to talk with Demi Dowdy for her media meltdown of the week. How are you doing, Demi?
Good. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing pretty well. So tell me, what are we talking about today?
Well, Matt, what we're going to talk about this week is the media's reaction and the statement from ESPN that they've pulled one of their announcers named Robert Lee from announcing the Virginia game because his name is Robert Lee. What's interesting about this is he is not from the South, as far as I understand. In fact, he is an Asian American with no affiliation to the Confederate General Robert E. Lee, but apparently just his name is offensive to some.
Right, and this is really odd to start, but let's start with the statement that ESPN released on this. So they say, "We collectively made the decision with Robert to switch games as the tragic events in Charlottesville were unfolding, simply because of the coincidence of his name. In that moment, it felt right to all parties. It's a shame that this is even a topic of conversation, and we regret that who calls play-by-play for a football game has become an issue." And what strikes me first on
that... Oh, I agree
with
that part, though.
Oh, I do, too. But the question is, who made it an issue?
Right.
And that's ESPN made it an issue.
Absolutely.
There was no call to have Robert Lee on a different game than the William & Mary Virginia game. There was no outcry of it. This was something created by ESPN, and then they talk about how it's a shame that this is a topic of conversation. They regret that it's an issue.
Yes, I agree, Matt. I don't think that this was a public outcry by any stretch. I think that ESPN and their leadership have a history of being very much part of the activist left, which is not unusual for anyone in the media, to be honest. I mean, but what we've seen from ESPN has been social justice efforts. And so this is not surprising, even though it's very, very odd. And I'm highly curious if this gentleman, Robert Lee, has ever been accused of being racist himself, or he's ever had anyone be offended just by his name.
I would doubt it's been an issue, honestly. I mean, this guy is not, I mean, it's just crazy to me. I mean, this is an Asian guy, or Asian descent guy, who is, no one has probably really, beyond just in passing in his life, ever equated him to Robert E. Lee. I mean, it's, and I don't think that it would have been an issue if he were to call this game. I don't think it would by any means.
Yeah, and I don't either. And what's funny, too, is I guess I shouldn't be shocked anymore by things like this. But when I first read that this was a rumor spreading on social media, I think it originated on a sports blog. And I honestly thought it was either a joke or it was fake news. I thought it was something being spread that wasn't true. So I'm flabbergasted that, in fact, it is true. I'm looking at an article from the New York Times. I saw reports on CNN. It's real.
I pretty much expected it to be like looking at the bottom and go, oh, it's an Onion article.
Yeah.
Nope, not fake at all. And I mean, this guy, Robert Lee, he's not that well known. He's he's from Albany, New York. I'm looking him up now. He has 1,100 followers on Twitter. He's, you know, he's not a crazy well-known guy. And but he hasn't addressed this on his personal Twitter yet, on his.
Yeah, I can almost guarantee that he has signed something saying he won't comment. So it's unlikely that we'll hear from him, I think. That's just my opinion, but we'll see. And, you know, what would be really fascinating is to see if he stays at ESPN. Maybe he does, as the statement said, maybe he does agree with the decision and he was part of the decision. But what's concerning about this, there's a lot of concerning things about this turn of events, but what's concerning about this is that somebody can be demoted or punished, per se, in their job, in their employment, just because of their name.
It does seem ridiculous. I mean, the more I think about it, the more I just go, this is crazy. I mean, his name is Robert Lee. So what? And this is a preemptive strike from ESPN to try and avoid, whether it's protests or embarrassment or just people making fun of it. But now everyone's making fun of it.
Yeah, because it's silly. I mean, this is how far the left has devolved. And, you know, they've strayed so far from logic, but now it's to the point of ridiculous. You know, and when hypersensitivity has become an issue and we take action that's so drastic based on the potential offensiveness of something so innocuous as a person's name with no actual relation to the original Confederate general, then we've gone from illogical to hysteria. And I think that most common people can say that this is ridiculous and see it for what it is.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, even if he was, you know, related to Robert E. Lee, even if there was an announcer who had some relation, still, so what?
Yep.
It's so what? I mean, beyond that, it's just, we're at a point where I don't recognize a lot of things that are happening. I just don't, I never thought we'd be here.
Yeah, me either. And what's really funny too is I don't know any reasonable person, even a reasonable person who does find themselves offended by the actual Confederate general, for instance. I don't know that I know anyone who would be offended by this person's name being Robert Lee. I don't think that is a real, true, valid concern. And I think it's another example of the media creating a narrative and creating an offense where there really isn't any.
Well, I've been on trolling on social media, running around, looking at different coverage of it, and I have not seen one person say one positive thing about pulling him off this game. Nobody who I have seen is going, you know, that's a good thing you did there. And nobody is.
Because it's crazy. And it's funny, too, and I don't want to stray too far off subject, but Charles Barkley recently made a statement about the debate over the removal of Confederate statues, and he said that he doesn't know another black person in his personal life who has ever had an issue was walking by a Confederate statue and they've never felt offended by that. He doesn't know anyone. And so, you know, I think so much of this is manufactured. And I believe that there are some people who are offended by walking by a Confederate statue. And I you know, let's hear that out and have a very logical debate about it. But I think it's so magnified and manufactured by the left to the point where now they don't have anyone standing up and backing them in their claim that there are people offended by something so silly as a person's name that sounds like a Confederate general.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, going back, you know, to the Confederate statues and monuments and all that, it seems in this whole conversation, what I'm noticing is the largely missing party from this discussion is the everyday African American. It's not the leaders, the NAACP leaders. It's not those people are there and talking, but it's the guys that you and I know.
Right.
It's those people, like, they don't seem to care. The average Joe doesn't seem to care. That's what I'm seeing.
And if there are people who care today and suddenly care, it's just strange how until the last couple of weeks, I've never heard that anyone was offended by these things, you know, and maybe that's naive of me, but there certainly was not this outcry and this sudden sentiment of being so offended.
All right, good. And maybe next week what you can bring for us is a segment on stories that seem fake but are actually real.
Oh, that's good.
It would be just like this Robert Lee story. It seems like it's going to be fake and then it turns out not to be.
We can do like two truths and a lie.
There we go.
Find the one that's fake.
Oh, yeah. Two real and a fake stories, you know. That'll be good. A banana truck turns over and cars slip and slide. And some guy named Robert Lee's pulled off of a story because of his, or a game because of his name. And then another one.
I would never have guessed that this were true, but it is.
I wouldn't either. Well, thanks for joining us and talking about this subject that is so off the wall.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. We're joined now by Dr. Bob Libke of the Civitas Institute. He is the Director of Policy for the Civitas Institute, but really his passion, I guess you would say, is education. Is that right, Bob?
That is correct, Matt.
All right. So we are going to sort of do, I guess, a back-to-school segment now with the school year kicking off either this week or next week and for different schools. And Bob is here to talk with us about enrollment changes and school choice growing in popularity, I believe.
That's right, Matt. Anybody who's watching the landscape of education in North Carolina the last couple of years knows that there has been a lot of changes as far as educational options. You know, since 1995, since 96, I think it was, the charter schools have been in existence, but as most people know, they were capped until the year 2010 at 100 schools. In 2011, the legislature lifted that cap, and they have exploded in popularity and number. So parents have the options of sending their kids to charter schools. They've always had the option of sending a child to private schools, and also they have the option of homeschooling. In addition to that, in the last few years, North Carolina parents who are eligible can also apply for what's called the Opportunity Scholarship, and that provides parents up to $4,200 per child. And they can use that money to send their child to a private school if they so choose. So there's a lot going on there. And actually, there have been a lot of my colleagues in the last month or so have been kind of talking about how school choice has exploded in North Carolina, and also that for many reasons we should call North Carolina the school choice state because of not only the number of programs, but also the numbers that we're talking about. So with that in mind, I did a little digging.
Well, real quick, Bob, what exactly is school choice for people who aren't really in that area? What is school choice?
Good question, Matt. School choice is premised on a belief that parents should be able to choose the best educational option for their child. Unfortunately, the way the current system is set up, most kids go to school based on where they live. And the problem with that is that we all know that schools are different. They're not always great. And unfortunately, a lot of kids that if they don't have access to a good school, that affects them later on in life. It gives them a poor start from the beginning, often of which they never are able to recover from. So we believe that all kids, that parents should be able to choose the best educational options. The way the system is currently set up, that's not the case. School choice has been around since about 1990. That was when the first program was, in its first modern day program. States like Vermont have had what are called tuition programs, where the actual town would provide money for kids in that town if they did not have a school. They could go to a neighboring town. That's was an early concept of a voucher. But the modern-day school choice movement dates to about 1990. Milwaukee was the first city in the country that had a voucher program. And we've kind of expanded in a number of ways since then. Charter schools have come along. There have been a number of tax credits, tuition scholarships, and a number of other programs like that. Most recently, the hot topic in school choice has been education savings accounts, of which, you know, North Carolina has passed a program in the last legislative session. So all those programs, the thing they have in common is that they empower parents to make that choice. And as you can see, parents are happy about them, kids are happy about them, they're popular, they're growing, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Okay, and then a charter school is a public school, right?
That's correct. A charter school is a public school. It is a school that is not controlled by a school board, but a private board, but does receive public taxpayer dollars. The other difference is that, generally speaking, they have greater flexibility to hire and are not subject to all the same administrative rules that traditional public schools are. And in that sense, they were supposed to be, and they are intended to be, somewhat what are called lab schools, you know, to foster innovation and to show other public schools what works, et cetera.
I mean, that seems like a really, I guess, forward-facing, looking-forward idea, a pretty new idea to kind of hand over this more control and flexibility to a charter school than the public school, the Wake County public school system has. It seems like a really interesting kind of experimental idea. So how long have charter schools been around?
Nationally, Minnesota had the first charter school. I think it was either 1989 or 1990. In North Carolina, first charter school law, I think, was passed in 95. The first one was in existence in, I think, 96. And as we all know, this legislature limited charter schools to 100, one per county. But in 2010, I believe, the cap was lifted, and now we have, I think, about 170 of them, and they've expanded significantly in number because there's been a big demand there.
So basically, there was about a 15-year period where it was capped at 100, and then half that time, you know, just that time, 7 years or so ago, they lifted that cap, and there's almost twice as many schools now.
I mean, correct. Now, they all have to be authorized and approved. There's a charter school authorizing board. They recommend those proposals to the state board. They ultimately have to sign off on it. So that I mean, there's pros and cons to the way that is set up, but the important point to remember is that they are public schools in that they receive state funding, but they are they have greater flexibility, and they're not administered by a school board, but by a private board, and they have greater flexibility. The incentive, the point being there is they wanted to help foster innovation and create schools built around different themes, et cetera.
Okay, I mean, and I actually went out, this is probably over a year ago now, to a charter school, and the way it struck me, it didn't feel like a public school. And I came up through the public school system, went to many different public schools, but it didn't feel like a public school in a lot of ways. It felt like more of a private school.
That's the case in many of them. Why that is because oftentimes they are much more focused around a particular value or a curriculum. There are charter schools that are built around certain disciplines like math and science. There are schools that are built around more traditional values, et cetera. And they're mostly more focused, and they're not subject to the same curricular limitations. But by design, they are intended to provide a more focused and, a differing approach to education than traditional public schools. Parents like that. I believe students like it. I mean, if you're more interested in math and science, you can choose a charter school that is more focused on that. If you're more interested in the arts and have a bent that way, you can make an option as well that way. The intent is to provide differing educational approaches and allow students and parents to choose the best one that fits them. And I think that's something that everybody can agree with.
Yeah, and it also, just from the way you described it, having a private controlling board as opposed to a school system who's, responsible for all the schools in the county in most cases, it seems that that school may be able to react quicker to the changing landscape of when something new presents itself. It seems like there's more ability to react in a charter school setting where you're responsible for this one school or a few schools, I guess.
I would agree with that, Matt. That's historically been the case. And also charters are, like public schools, are enrollment driven. But the charters, I think, are more sensitive to that because generally they draw their students from a larger area. They have to appeal to a certain type of students. They don't have a target geographical area where all schools, where all students by default will go to that school. So I think they, by nature, have to be more attentive to parental and student concerns. So I think what you said is true.
So it sounds like, I mean, they're fighting for their students in a lot of ways. They have to attract the students to them. It's not like when you go and so-and-so address goes to this school, the public school. It's they know they're going to get the vast majority of those kids, I guess. That some will go to private schools, some will go to charter schools, but the vast majority of the kids in a district will go to the school they're directed to. Am I right?
That's correct. And the whole intent, again, is to go back to the original purpose, is to provide a greater range of educational options, to realize that the more options that a child has and is better, and also that, kids should have an option to study more than one approach. And a lot of the charter schools vary in their educational approach, not only instructional but curricular. And so, when parents are looking at those options, they have the opportunity to explore the distinctives of each of these schools and match, what best suits them. This is not to say that charters are better. What it does is it provides another option for kids. And we know that kids are all different. Not everybody fits in a traditional public school. Not everybody fits in a public charter. The point is, parents know the bent of their child. They know their educational needs, And I think there's agreement that parents should be able to meet those needs and send their child to the school that best meets them.
Okay, and that kind of, I guess, brings us back to your original topic of school choice. I kind of pulled you down a rabbit hole there.
No, that's okay. In fact, I'm glad you did because I think oftentimes, and I know I'm guilty of this too, we traffic in all these terms, but a lot of people might not know exactly, you know, what they mean, what their historical origins are in that. And I think that's good that you asked that, Matt.
All right, so back to what you're here to talk about, I guess, the explosion of school choice, and you mentioned ESAs and education savings accounts that were becoming more popular. So where are we with that?
Well, where we are now is, as I said before, there's been a fair amount of commentary on school choice exploding. And, I read the papers, I read journals and so forth, and I'm aware of the landscape here. And so I just dug into a little bit of, you know, enrollment, changes in enrollment and so forth over the last 10 years, we readily can get that data. And so I, you know, dug up some numbers on how enrollment has changed over the last 10 years. And the numbers I dealt with were just basically for the last 10 years. We looked at student enrollments from 2006-07 to 2016-17. And what we did, we looked at overall growth changes for traditional public schools, charter schools, private schools, and homeschools. The last three of those options, as I said, charter, private schools, and homeschools, we would view as what are called choice schools in the sense that parents have to actively choose that option. When you go to a traditional public school, it's somewhat the default option. So, in other words, if you don't choose another school, that choice is already made for you.
Right.
So what did we find over the last 10 years? The overall total new student enrollment for the last 10 years, in other words, how many students were added to K-12 in the last 10 years? That number's 173,833, basically 174,000 new students in the last 10 years. The amount of new traditional public school students, 48,835. The number of new charter school students since 2006-07, 60,058. The number of private school students that increased since 2006-07, 5,800. And the number of new homeschool students since 2006-07, 59,140. Now, those four numbers sum to 173,833, okay? In the last 10 years, the percentage of students attending traditional public schools has dropped. In 2006-07, it was 88%. Now in 2016-17, it's dropped to 82%, okay? Which is a significant drop. The percentage of students attending charter schools has increased from 2% in 2006-07 to 5% in 2006-07. For private schools, it's basically remained the same. Private schools, which we expect to go up, these are all increasing at strong rates, which means parents like and they want choice.
Sounds like altogether a pretty positive thing and a growing thing. And thanks for coming on and talking with us about it.
Thank you, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polscher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Okay, thank you to everyone who was involved in the show today, Susan Myrick, Demi Dowdy, and Dr. Bob Libke, but also thanks to you, the listeners. And I will say it one more time, if you're not already subscribed to the show, make sure you're doing that, because you don't want to miss any of these episodes about what matters in North Carolina. We'll catch you next time.